So I think both of the books that I said we would order are in. This one came in this week, Don't Waste Your Breath. So I heard a couple people, well, somebody in the office said when they saw the cover that, I got to read this book just from looking at the cover. This is a pretty neat cover. I'm sure it's kind of misty, vapory, okay? But the theme of Ecclesiastes. So we're going to be in Ecclesiastes 2 today. And there is a handout. There is some space for you to take notes, hopefully. I never know how much to leave there. Don't know how much you people take notes. But anyway, hopefully you have that in hand. And Ecclesiastes 2, in general, is kind of answering the question that Solomon asked in chapter 1. What benefit or what profit is there from a man's toil under the sun? So he's coming back to that theme again, and also the thesis that everything, at least everything that he's talking about in Ecclesiastes, is vanity, or it's vapor, it's futile, there's a futility to it. So that's kind of the whole theme of chapter 2. We're going to look at four different areas of vanity today. So let's get right into it in chapter 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. So Solomon is telling himself, I'm going to run a test here. I'm going to enjoy myself with pleasure. But then he says, he gives a summary, but behold, this is also his vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So it seems like he is legitimately doing a analysis, an investigation, or experiment about, I'm just going to see if a person can enjoy life, and I'm going to indulge myself in pleasure, laughter, wine, even how to lay hold on folly. And when it comes to wine, he said, my heart's still guiding me with wisdom, so I'm going to enjoy wine, but I'm going to do it with wisdom. So he's also seeking to be wise through all of this. So he gives us his conclusion already in verse 1, and that is that even this enjoyment of pleasures is ultimately hevel. That's the word for vapor. I like the Strong's definition of that word, which is just it's fleeting and it's unsatisfactory. And I think that is, it's not satisfying. And I like that because I think that's really his conclusion, is that all these things that I sought in this world, they're just unsatisfying. This experiment I ran, I'm not satisfied with it. I'm left empty. So, the preacher runs this grand experiment. He's going to live a life of pleasure to see what was good for the sons of Adam during our few days under the sun. And the first one that he gets to is laughter. And in verse 4 of chapter 3, we'll be getting to that next week, he talks about laughter. There's a time to mourn, there's a time to laugh. And so laughter is actually a good thing. Here, I think it's not just the laughs that come from spontaneous, pleasurable things of life, but I think he's really talking about entertainment. So maybe more the entertainment part, comedy. I would go to what we have today, like there's a huge entertainment business out there, right? So I think this is more what he's talking about. I want to find comedy, entertainment. I want to entertain myself. But he found that even to be vapor. And I think this really goes to what we see in our own life, our own experience. I did just a little research, and comedians and entertainers experience a higher rate of depression. And what the world would call mental illness, and suicide rates are actually higher. And you kind of probably already know about the sad clown type of thing, clown that's supposed to be fun and entertain you, but they're really behind that mask, some of the saddest people out there, because it's vapor, it's futile, and it does not satisfy. The elevated suicide rate and premature death, you would probably even know some of the entertainment world that's true of. So Solomon found that out and wrote that down for our wisdom and for our experience. Then he said, I'm going to cheer my heart with wine. I think he's really saying, can wine, can those kinds of drinks numb the pain of this vaporous life? And can it give me satisfaction? And again, I think his answer to that is no. This also passes away. It's not satisfying. So it got me to thinking, like, what are some of the self-indulgent pleasures that can occupy the mind, the pursuit, the life of believers in the year 2026 that tend to numb or obscure the reality of this short life? What are some things that we can get into without really realizing it, maybe, that were pursuits that Solomon had, things that we seek after to try to find satisfaction in?
Easy one is social media.
I think that's right up there. Brock said social media. So do you need any further comments on that, Brock?
There's a lot of this. They even have the term doom scrolling, is just constantly just looking for the next thing to be entertained. And it just, if it was satisfying, you wouldn't spend endless time doing that, but it just never satisfies. You always need more. So,
yeah. What profit is there in that? I remember sitting beside somebody on an airplane, and they spent the whole 3-hour flight scrolling through reel after reel after reel. It's not to condemn them. It's just that's people's pursuit. That's entertainment. Other thoughts, comments on things that can become.
A news this week that I think one of the countries didn't allow kids have cell phones the age such and such age after high school, and scrolling down Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, their mind do not engage with schoolwork and that school.
Yeah.
And then they do other stuff like playing with friends or other stuff. So,
you know what country that was? I did hear that.
Australia.
Yeah. I know here at the high school in Emporia that maybe Votech, I don't know too. Is that right, Joe?
We don't have to. That's up to the teacher.
But I think at the high school, Scott Marshall was saying.
K-12 schools in Kansas have to.
They have to.
Bell and Bell. Okay. They have to be inaccessible now.
Yeah. Praise God.
Yeah.
We're swinging back. Hopefully
John,
get to
John, anecdotally, I was thinking about this, and I know other people probably are more sanctified than I am. But there have been two instances in the past year where I've like really had to struggle against the pull of social media as a comfort in a way. So we're sitting in the hospital with Ren earlier in the year, and instead of just sitting there and like praying for her and comforting my wife and doing those things, like it's crazy to me how I had to consciously battle the pull of social media because it is such such a false comfort in a way. It's easy for me to mindlessly scroll and just exit my current reality and enter this really, it's a a simulation, right? It's a fake world that I'm going into that feeds me what I want it to, hunting videos or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Like, it gives me what I want to so I can escape reality for a little while. And so, like, I found myself having to consciously fight against the pull of that and to say, I'm gonna pray for my daughter, I'm gonna pray for my wife, I'm gonna pray that we can be, you know, testimony to the nursing staff and to these folks that are seeing us go through this and stuff. Like, so that was the first one. Then obviously we were in the hospital with Caroline, but it was crazy to me how big of a pull the phone in my pocket had to my attention and my desires. And so I know other people are probably not in the same boat that I am, but it was just crazy to me. So that was the first thing. And I think secondly, like, as a culture, we have no idea how much more, like, we have than Solomon had when it comes to pleasures and comforts. Like, he didn't have air conditioning, he didn't have electricity, he didn't have plumbing. And so, like, there's a lot of these things that I'm reading in Ecclesiastes. Like, Solomon was chasing these things and chasing all of, you know, all these pleasures of the world. And we have to think he had less than we have on average. He had less variety in his food. He had less access to drugs and SSRIs and all these different, like, he had less access to those things than we have. And so for us, we have to really take this with a grain of salt, because oftentimes we can read it and think, wow, Solomon was way more blessed. No, actually, we have it a lot better than he did. So
yeah. Walk into Costco, right, or wherever, like, we have all these things. Yeah, you're right about that. And by the way, I don't think you're alone. I saw a lot of heads shaking when you're talking about the conscious effort it takes, the determination to turn off this type of entertainment. Just the mind-numbing binge of online games and card games. You can go on and on. Facebook Reels. People that stream hours of TV series. It's there. It's right at our fingertips. Movies. The private consumption of digital adult and pornographic content is off the charts. All of those things. I mean, he's going to talk about pleasure here a little bit later. That's just out there. What are some scriptures that could bring some teaching or correction instruction in regards to pleasure? And I probably need to make the comment that when he was talking about testing pleasure here, pleasure can be a legitimate enjoyment of life that he actually affirms is good in Ecclesiastes 8:15. So there's a lot of pleasures that are good, and we're going to enjoy them, like food. We are to enjoy that. On and on you can go. I think what he had in mind here is more the self-indulgent or the merrymaking, the frivolous kind of entertainment. So keep that in mind. Banqueting, drinking, I think that's what was in view here when it comes to pleasure. So what would, can you think of some scripture that would just be helpful for us that kind of bring us back to where we need to be when it comes to pleasure, particularly those kinds of pleasures?
I think considering other people's interests greater than your own.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff is selfish, self-directed.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really good one.
I thought of the set your minds on things above.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we looked at the things that are not seen. I thought of Hebrews 11:25. Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God and to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. There's a couple words in there that were very intentional. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God. That's what we have to do. I'm going to refuse to be consumed with self-indulgent pleasures. I'm going to enjoy suffering affliction with the people of God.
I have two verses. One is Joshua 24:15. It says, My house we serve the Lord.
It's a good one, Josh.
And then Isaiah 55:8-9 is my favorite. It says, my ways, God's way is not always our thought, it's not our thought. So we need to think that God's way is higher than always.
Mm-hmm. John, I think of Romans 6:21. What benefit are you having from the things of which you are now ashamed? It's like those things. In the moment, it always seems like it's this is a good thing, and then later you regret and you're filled with shame. And so that one, and then Romans 8 is that those early verses are contrasting life in the spirit. The mindset on the flesh is death in verse 6. Like that is something to remind. Okay, if I'm just continually giving in to my flesh all the time, that's a bad path towards destruction.
Those are good ones. The first one was Romans 6.
6:21.
21.
And then
chapter 8 of Romans, mm-hmm. particularly the first six or eight verses of contrast, the minding the spirit and minding the flesh. Those are all good.
I think.
Go ahead.
2 Corinthians 1, when it talks about comfort, I think it just reorients the way we're supposed to think about comfort. Because I think so much of our life is geared toward getting to an end of a thing, like if I could just get this laundry done, or if I could just, you know, like you're always just, and then there's more, right? And we're always, it's like, or we're working until we can get to vacation, or we're working until we can get to retirement, or we're working, raising children until they can leave, or, you know, whatever, get to school. That shouldn't be our goal. The goal of comfort isn't to achieve like a state where you don't have to do anything, or where you can be at peace. The goal of God's comfort is so that we can comfort other people. Like if you've been blessed financially and you have comfort that way, it's mm-hmm. you want to be a comfort that way. And I know it's extending that passage just a little more, but if your goal is always to just get to the place where you don't, and that's self-focused and it's never done.
A lot of our life is spent trying to find comfort or be comfortable or happiness. That's a good point.
1 Corinthians 23, all things are lawful but not all things are helpful, all things are lawful but not all things build up. And then it kind of goes on and concludes, you know, so whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all the glory of God.
That was 1 Corinthians
10:23.
Yeah.
Psalm 16 talks about the preservation of God's saints. At the end, he says, "You made known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hands are pleasures forevermore."
That's a great verse. Head that one down. Good one right there. So where are pleasures? They're in the presence of God. Mm-hmm. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And then Brianna, the one she said, you're eating and drinking, you should do all that for the glory of God, not for your self-indulgent pleasure. Pretty amazing how clear the scriptures can be. Good. You guys came up with some good ones there. Let's move on to second page. So he continues, he's turning his experiment now to testing materialism. I want to read 4 through 11. "I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all those who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I'd expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Wow, he went all in. So verses 4 and 5, he built great works, houses, he planted vineyards, gardens, parks, fruit trees. Verse 6 and 7, he built pools. He was the ultimate irrigator for you farmers in here. He built pools to water his trees. He had male and female slaves. He had herds of cattle like nobody before him. He had flocks of sheep. Pretty amazing how big his herds were. Went back and looked at 1 Kings chapter 4, if you want to write this in your notes just for a reference. 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 22, 23. His daily amount of food and amount of stuff that he had to have to maintain his royal court, we read there was, let me get over there and make sure I got this right. Solomon's provision for one day were 30 cores of fine flour. That would have been 5 bushel per core, which comes out to, listen to this, farmers, 150 bushels of flour daily for his provisions for his court. He had need for 300 bushels of meal or cereal. He had 10 fattened calves who'd been fattened in the stall. Now, they might not have been 1,500 pounds at slaughter like they are today, but they would have been, anyway, 10 head of calves daily needed to be fattened for his provisions. In addition, 20 calves from the pasture, 100 sheep, besides rams, gazelles, deer, and fattened fowl. That's all in 1 Kings 14, or 4, 14 through 28. Wow! I mean, that, you talk about big herds and lots of people to work, slaves that he, so he just went all out. And people were coming from all over the world to see this man's, what he had, his wisdom and his court. Pretty amazing to me how he got all this done. In addition, he his kingdom stretched, and I thought this was interesting, stretched from the Euphrates River to Egypt. And I think that was really the extent of what the land was promised Abraham. So he actually was able to conquer the land and had under his control what was originally promised to Abraham for the people of Israel. So his experiment, he went all in, and yet he said at the end of it, I found it unsatisfying, because I think it was a selfish, indulgent pleasure that he was looking for out of it. He talks about in verse 8, I gathered silver and gold and treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines and delight of the sons of men. It is said that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. The wives would have been princesses, the royalty of his court. He had 300 concubines. Looked into the concubines a little bit. They were more than a slave, but less than a wife. They were still property and could be used for his own sexual use as well. So crazy to think about the extent to what he went into. Just he went all in. And also when he talked about gold and silver, he was getting 25 tons of gold per year was being brought to him. And that didn't even include the tribute that he was getting from those kingdoms that he had conquered and that were under his control. And even it says in Scripture in Kings that silver was as common as stone in Israel. So it wasn't even a big thing to have silver. This is how much he gathered in. This is the extent of what he went into materialism in his lifetime. So any comments from that about the extent of his materialism? What was his conclusion? What was the preacher's conclusion regards to materialism, and how should this conclusion shape our lives? So what did he end up saying about it?
It was of no gain.
No gain.
I think when we pursue this, the materialism is for our own selfish, to boost our ego, to bring, find some sort of satisfaction, but it's never enough. Because, well, I've got this much, but I need that much more. Because once you get something, and that's what you put your satisfaction in, it's like, well, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? And then you, at the end of life, you're like, I'm still unsatisfied. I'm still not complete. So there's no gain. There's no satisfaction in it.
That's the pattern of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And success is based on how much I have.
What's the old term? Keeping up with the Joneses?
Keeping up, yeah.
Yeah.
Lee and Chelsea, yeah.
John, are we sure that his wisdom remained with him in verse 9? Because, I mean, you for 700 wives, we sure that's wise. And then how do you pursue some of these things and not follow them down the trenches into sin and use that wisely?
He said his wisdom remained with him, but we also know the rest of the story. These wives that he took from the people group that the Lord says you shall not marry, that were supposed to be removed from Canaan, were the ones that turned him away from God. So, yeah, I think when he said wisdom remained with him as he pursued wine, I think he meant that he didn't, I don't think he was drunk, if that makes sense. I think he was, kept his right mind about him. I think that's what he meant by that. And later he's going to talk about, he did pursue wisdom, but wisdom is better than folly. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but I kind of had the same question as you. But he's telling us, I kept my wisdom even though I was pursuing all these foolish things. Kind of an oxymoron in a way. Any other conclusions you can have about materialism? I think the three things that he said in verse 11 are really instructive to us. When he considered all that his hands had done and the toil that he expended in doing it, all was vanity. It's vapor, it passes away. He's going to talk about that in a little bit. There's a futility to it. It's still unsatisfying. Secondly, it's like striving after the wind. Jared, you're a roper. Can you rope the wind? Right? Like, that's what he means. You can't grasp. You can't lay hold on it. And thirdly, there's just nothing to be gained under the sun. There's no profit. There was no profit to him, ultimately, because he was chasing things that are passing away, that are vapor in nature. So next he turns to what Leah was talking about, Ecclesiastes 2, 12 through 17, page 3, wisdom. It's better than folly. And then he talks about the end of the wise and the fool. He says this, so I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. So he's going to do an investigation of wisdom, madness, and folly. For what can a man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is no more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there's no more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all this vanity and striving after the wind. So I think his investigation continues here. It's an all-inclusive one. He's going to talk about wisdom and madness and folly. And in verse 12, I found that kind of an odd statement for what can the man do? What can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Is a human life able to come along who will be better than Adam? Is kind of the literal translation of that. Found that interesting, the original Adam. What can be better than what comes after Adam? Nobody will solve the mystery, is what he's saying. Adam couldn't. I can't. Nobody that comes after me. Neither Adam or Solomon was able to solve it. So I think that's what he was saying in verse 12. It was a little bit of a strange comment, but I think that is the essence of that. So in verse 13, then I saw that there's more gain in wisdom than folly, as there's more gain in light than in darkness. So wisdom has its limitations, but it's still better than being a fool, is what he's saying. It's better than living a life of folly. Verse 14 has eyes in his head. I think that is what he means by that. Lee, and this might be helpful, is that it's to say that he can see where I'm going, whereas a fool walks in darkness and can't see where he's going. So I think he maintained that ability to see life, to interpret it, to come to conclusions, whereas a fool doesn't know. Has eyes in his head is just a reference to being able to see while the fool can't see and he walks in darkness. But then he says what happens to both of them. But he says the same event, what does that mean?
They die.
Yeah. This guy's a downer, isn't he? But it's true. It's realistic. It's a slam in the face, right up in our face. Verse 15, what happens to the fool happens to me also. I think he's saying wisdom is better than folly, yet it can't stop death. That was his conclusion. One author said, and I really like this, that death is a sudden period at the end of vapor. Sudden period. Death is a sudden period at the end of vapor. Then in verse 16, he said, there's no remembrance of either the wise or the foolish. It's true. So in verse 17, I hated life because what is done on the sun was grievous to me for all this vanity and striving after the wind. If you'll flip over to page 4, I wanted to read a quote in reference to that verse that I thought was helpful. This is from a quote by Daniel Fredericks in Brian Borgman's book, Don't Waste Your Breath. The expression of hatred for this life is more a mark of piety than a mark of bitterness. And I found that to be, I think that's true. If Koheleth, which is the preacher, had not felt the deep pain of Hebel, then the curse would have been a curse. Koheleth's bubble burst and the joy got sucked right out of his life. He looked at his toil. He looked at his wisdom. He thought he had grasped the reward. And it became hateful to him because in the end it was simply a breath, nothing lasts. In addition, the toll was grievous. Everything is still vapor, and all the efforts and attainments are a great vexation to the spirit because it is still an impossible task. The hunger for more, the hunger for permanence, and the hunger for significance and reward don't just linger. They consume this brief blip on the screen we call life. The hunger is never satisfied. When we think it is satisfying like Chinese food is filling. We just hunger again in half an hour. Koheleth felt the pain of Hebel deeply. And I think that is his conclusion. It's actually a good conclusion to come to. And we need to come to that as we live in this world under the curse. So, I have a question. Should we pursue wisdom as we live life under the sun? What are the benefits of wisdom? see some people shaking their head that we should. Mm-hmm. Should we?
Yes.
Yep.
Proverbs says, whatever you do, get
wisdom. Yeah. That's exactly one of the conclusions of Proverbs. Get wisdom. This writer wrote that. So remember, he said, wisdom is better than folly. So yeah, get wisdom. Benefits of wisdom, we could spend hours on that, and for the interest of time, I'm not going to, but wisdom will save you from a lot of things in this life. Wisdom is the skill of living well from God's perspective.
John, wouldn't you say too that it's wisdom that he can even see that it's a breath, it's a vapor? Like, fools won't even take that into consideration.
Yeah.
And so wisdom sees that life is but a breath.
Great point. That's one of his conclusions. Wisdom is, life is a breath. Great point, Lindsay. I love that. And so we need to know that. The fool doesn't know that. The fool says there is no God, and there is no judgment, and he lives life the way he lives life. So huge benefits of wisdom. It keeps us from evil. People who live lives of wisdom are happy. They're blessed. There's honor from wisdom. Proverbs is full of that. We could go on and on in terms of the benefits of wisdom. So don't leave here thinking, I don't know, I used to get wisdom. In the end, it's a vapor. Yeah, it is, but it's wisdom will make you wise to salvation in the end.
I think it's important to have the right attitude about your wisdom as well. I mean, you don't boast in your wisdom. You remain humble and you use it for God's purposes.
If you don't remain humble, it's not wisdom, right?
Right.
In the end. Yeah. Well, the preacher in Ecclesiastes 2:18 through 26, he laments the realities and limitations of this life under the sun, yet closes with some good news. We're finally starting to get some good news from his experiment. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be a master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about, gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who is toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There's nothing better. Here's the good news. There's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I say, is from the hand of God. There's the grace of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Wow, that was a mouthful there. Have you ever thought about all your toiling and laboring for will be left to somebody else? Right? It's good to think about that from time to time. Somebody else will live in the house you're living in someday. Somebody else will be taking care of the land that you're taking care of. On and on we could go. He found that to be a troubling, vexing thing. Because I don't know who's going to come after me. But we don't get to control that. But I love that he finally has some things for us to rejoice over. And that is that we can eat and drink and find enjoyment in this life because this is from the hand of God. What is from the hand of God? The ability to enjoy the good gifts, to enjoy him and the good gifts that he has given us. And to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. And I think that's William Barrick's point when he calls Ecclesiastes the Philippians of the Old Testament. This really is a book about finding joy, not satisfaction in this world, finding joy in God and his good gifts. I think verse 24, we should take that to mean that even with the limitations of this life, which we're realistic about the fact that it's passing away, that we're going to die, that it's a vapor, that it goes quickly, that some of what we do is quite futile. But even with this, we should rejoice in the temporal goodness that God has given us. Don't focus on what is lost and the end of toil, but focus on the temporal goodness that God has given us. This is from the hand of God. I did not put this quote in the lesson, but I liked what Brian Borgman says. The first leg of the ride of Ecclesiastes come to an end. Preacher tells us there's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. He saw this from the hand of God. God has given us wisdom and knowledge and joy. And he says this, and I think, well, is that very spiritual to eat and drink and enjoy the gifts that God has given me? And he says this, this is far more spiritual than it sounds. There's nothing better is literally, this is good. So God is saying to us, this is good. And that refers to what is truly good, spiritually good in the sight of God. So when God says it's good for you to eat, drink, and enjoy the gifts he's given you, this is good. Where else did he say this is good? After he had the creation, right? So the conclusion is powerful. It is good for man to enjoy the simple pleasures of life, eating, drinking, and laboring under the sun. He should recognize that those simple pleasures are from the hand of God. They are indeed gifts from him. What spoils them, and this is key, is our hunger to get out of them more than what they can give. So, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? In him we live and move and have our being. If we live life eating, drinking, and working without recognizing that these are God's gift to us, if we live life and think these things are rewards to be earned rather than gifts to be enjoyed, then Hebel, vapor, vanity will crush us with disappointments. But, as he says in verse 26, for to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. The one who has received God's favor, God gives the gift of not only wisdom and knowledge, but also enjoyment. The capacity to enjoy the gifts of God is a gift from God. So that's kind of the conclusion of the second chapter. Next week, we're going to get into the 14 different couplets about a time and season for everything. And I'm looking forward to that as well. So I had one question here at the end of that particular section. How are you doing? Are you enjoying the good gifts that God has given? I'm going to be real blunt. Are you enjoying the spouse that God has given you? Are you enjoying the children that God has given you? Are you enjoying the work, toil that God has given you? I'm asking myself these questions. Are you enjoying the place in life that God has placed you in? If you're not, then go to him. He's given you these things to enjoy, and it is his grace. It's a gift, right? And gift is another word for grace. It's the grace of God to be able to enjoy it. So if you're not enjoying it, take your eyes off of finding happiness in these things and finding happiness in God. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore, and your presence is fullness of joy. So I think that's a question you don't have to answer out loud, but answer yourself. How are you doing? Are you enjoying the good gifts that God has given you? Probably don't have time to read clear through it, but I wanted to, I put some other quotes in the notes here that I think would be helpful. You guys have been very helpful to me. At the very end, I put at the bottom of page 5, I put a portion of an article that was written by John MacArthur before before he died, and he put it in the form of a little booklet. It was called On Finishing Well. So I know some of you are pretty young in here, and thinking about finishing is maybe far from your mind, but I think that's good, not for just older people to think about finishing well, but all of us, especially in light of Ecclesiastes, and we understand the vaporous nature of life, fleeting nature of life. How do I finish well? So read through that in your spare time. Not spare time, choose to read through it. I think you'll find it really, really helpful to just be a bolster, an instruction that I think would be helpful as we go through the book of Ecclesiastes. I did want to get into the middle part of page 6 before we go here. The paragraph that starts, and here is one reason that is such a problem, and he's talking about gifted servants of Christ who fall into sin later in life. This is true for you younger and middle-aged people that think, are hopeful that it's going to get easier as life gets on. And he says, living the Christian life faithfully is no more trouble-free the older we get. That's a true statement.
That's true.
I don't know if you thought about that. There's a lot more dark hair in here than there is gray hair. But that is a true statement. Sanctification doesn't come any more easily with advanced age. The number and intensity of the firing darts, the powers of evil aim at us, does not diminish. Don't kid yourself. That is a true statement. The obstacles we face don't get easier to overcome. Furthermore, Scripture warns us, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. So I think this really, Ecclesiastes and this particular article, I think just arm us well for the life that we're in, hit us with the realities of life. You will never find a spot where you, if you do, you're in trouble. You're getting ready to fall. If you're comfortable with your sanctification, you're comfortable with how you're living your life faithfully, it doesn't get easier with advanced age for those who are in the Lord. But read the rest of this. This is a really strong appeal to finishing well, no matter whether you have a year or 10 or 15 or 50. We all want to finish well, and I think Ecclesiastes helps us get on the right path and get on the course that will take us to a good end. So we will see you next week, Lord willing, and we'll get into chapter 3.